Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
So this evening, we're honored to have as our speaker, Sosan Teresa Flynn. And she is a president of the SZBA. She is a guiding teacher at Clouds and Water Zen Center in Minnesota, where she has been practicing since 1994. And she was ordained by Dosho Port. Please correct me if I'm wrong here, Sosan. Ordained by Dosho Port in 1997. She has also practiced with Byakuren Judith Ruggier and received Dharma transmission from Joanne Snyder O'Neill in 2012. In addition to that, she also has a master's degree in counseling psychology with professional experience in community mental health and staff training, and she has a personal interest in diversity, equity, and inclusion, as well as intergenerational practice and ethics. Welcome, Sosa.
Thank you for having me. And thanks, Les, for inviting me.
Les, is there anything that you would like to say in terms of introducing Sosan? I just used what was online.
Oh, well, Sosan and I are just getting to know each other. We're starting to have an interesting relationship. We've got a project or so that we're going to be working on together, and I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you. Me too. Great. So actually, Les asked me if I would talk a little bit about the SZBA, the Soto Zen Buddhist Association, and kind of its history and what we're doing and why you might care about it or not. So I thought I would talk about that. It's sort of, it's like how the Dharma is manifesting in a certain kind of way here in this country. So I'm going to give a little bit of history, and I'll give a little bit of what we're doing now, and then I'll open it up for questions. So how many of you have heard of the SZBA? Well, some of you don't have your video on, so I can't tell, but those who have, just, you know, so a few people have heard about it. Okay, great. So maybe this might be a review for some who have heard about it, but and there also might be some things that I don't know, because I haven't been involved with the organization from its very beginning. I started practicing in 1994. The idea for forming the SZBA, I think, was hatched in 1995, but I didn't know anything about it at the time. So what I understand is that there was this idea to form an American association that would be have a somewhat of a relationship to the Japanese Soto Shu, but be autonomous. And so this is what I know about the Japanese Soto Shu, that organization. So that's an organization that registers Zen priests and temples and connects them. I also know that those who are, if you want to be registered with Soto Shu, you need to have completed some requirements like having done 2 3-month residential training periods in Japan and have received Dharma transmission from someone whose ordination and transmission is recognized by Soto Shu in Japan. So some North American Zen priests do not have this, and actually was starting to be like more and more didn't, because people didn't have the finances or the time to be able to do 2 3-month residential practice periods in Japan. So there was an idea like, well, what do we do then with these ordained priests who are teaching in North America, but can't be a member of this organization? So there was the idea, well, let's do an organization that's for American Zen priests. So the SCBA was formed, first in 1996, and your teacher, Les Kay, was one of the founding board members, so maybe that's partly why some of you might know about it. And with other people who were members of Suzuki and Maizumi lineages. And even though it was seemed a really great idea, apparently gathering interest in the organization was difficult at first. So it kind of was, the idea was there, but it lay dormant for a while. And my understanding is Sojin Mel Weitzman kind of held the organization together. But then eventually a new board was formed and started meeting regularly in 2002. And Les Kay continued on that board. So thank you very much, Les, for really, you know, being there from the beginning. And to me, the organization is so meaningful now that I'm just really have a debt of gratitude to everyone who started it out. So just a little more history. The first national conference was held in 2004, and there were 50 attendees and 10 lineages represented. So just to say, some of those lineages were from teachers who were pivotal in establishing Soto Zen in America by leading sanghas on American soil. So that included Tozen, Akiyama, Kobanchino, Dainin Katagiri lineage, which is my lineage, Jiyu Kennett, Taizan Maizumi, and Shunryu Suzuki lineages. And there were also some lineages from teachers who remained in Japan but were important in establishing Soto Zen in America. And those included Daito Noda, Tetsume Niho, Kudo Nishijima, and Butsugen Joshin. And I just say those names, you might know some of them and you might not. But I feel like I wanted to say their names to honor them and to thank them. So this first conference in 2004 was apparently very inspiring, and many working committees were formed, a new board was established, and one of the other things that happened at this first conference was that there was a Dharma heritage ceremony performed. And this was a way of recognizing sort of publicly and communally the Dharma transmission of those who aren't recognized by the Soto Shu in Japan. And that Dharma heritage ceremony continues to this day. So that is something that the SCBA offers. So other things that started to be offered, the first training event for associate members, and those were people who had not yet received Dharma transmission, but were training in these lineages. And that was in 2005, and it was a 10-day training focusing on the morning service. It was taught by Diane Benage, and that was at Mount Equity in Pennsylvania. Then in 2007, there was the first national Ango, so a practice period in the United States for that anyone in the country could participate in, and that was held at Jikoji Zen Temple in Los Gatos, California. And there were four guiding teachers for that Ango, each stayed a week. So again, Diane Benage, and then Echo Little, Sojin Weitzman, and Jisho Warner. And this was the opportunity for ordained priests to practice together with a group of peers. And it gave associate members, so again, those who hadn't received Dharma transmission yet, a chance to practice intensely with multiple teachers. And then also in 2007, the first edition of the priest training document was completed. So it was called Guidelines for the Formation of Soto Zen Priests in the West. And then a newer updated version was approved in 2017. The third national conference was in 2008, and that was held at San Francisco Zen Center and Green Gulch Farm. Now, that was my first conference, and I attended as an associate member. And I have to say, it was very, to me, it was so beneficial. So sometimes I felt like, well, I didn't get to sit at the adult table. I was at the kid table with the associate members at Green Gulch while the full members met at City Center. But on the other hand, that feeling was kind of short-lived because for the most part, I was so grateful to get together with my peers from all over the country and talk about issues that were of importance to us. And that was really an important way for us to figure out how we're carrying the Dharma forward. And I feel like this is something that really continues to this day in the SCA, that we're looking at ways to develop and strengthen the presence of Soto Zen in America. We're looking at how we can nurture relationships to the tradition of Soto Zen and cultivate connections within our lineages and across our lineages. So I want to say that my, if I would express like how I see the vision for SCBA right now, it is really about providing a space for connection. And it's about learning and education and sharing among the many lineages. And then also that we have created and continue to refine a structure to ensure that we have robustly trained priests who are adequately prepared to meet the spiritual needs of their sanghas as well as society. So right now, SCBA has about 280-some member priests. I think about 167 are full members or Dharma transmitted members, and about 116 are associate members. One of the most active committees of the SCBA currently is the Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, and Access Committee. And that committee is looking at internal and external ways to promote social justice for underserved groups. And I served on that committee before I joined the board, and that's actually one of the reasons why I continue to stay involved in SCBA, is because I feel like what the organization is doing now is so vital and critical to what's happening in the world and our society. So one of the other things that the current board is looking at is exploring ways to welcome more members to SCBA who would bring rich voices and perspectives that are a valuable part of the Soto Zen collective in America, because we know that the Dharma is being unfolded not just by priests. So priests are definitely in an important position to lead sanghas, to ordain people, to do jukai ceremonies, but we're all doing this together. We're all bringing the Dharma to the world together, and we're unfolding it together. So how can we provide even more support for that happening? That's something we're looking at. And then just say some of the activities that we're doing. So some of the things are like directly for supporting priests who can then, you know, in turn support their sanghas. And so a few of those are, we have a mentoring program, and that is so that that's particularly for priests in training, although even Dharma transmitted priests can have sort of a mentor or a collegial kind of relationship with someone in a different lineage. So the idea is that, let's say there's a priest who's ordained and they're in training and they're working with the teacher in a particular lineage, but then they could have a mentor in a different lineage, just someone to connect with, give them a broader sense of Soto Zen tradition. I know for me, when I first started studying Zen, I thought that the way my teacher was teaching it and the way we were doing it at my sangha was the only way. I didn't even realize that there were different ways of doing things that would be equally right and equally wholesome and equally Soto Zen. So to have that, you know, sort of in the structure, like that people can really start to learn that, I think is important. And the idea is that if we have these mentoring relationships, that within a generation, then the Soto Zen lineages in the United States will be more connected to each other and more mutually responsive. We have about 12 members right now who are actively engaged in mentoring relationships. So that's 24 people who are doing that. We also offer peer groups. These are made up of five to six members who meet regularly. Usually it's over Zoom or phone, because they're from all different parts of the country, and different lineages and different backgrounds. I'm in a peer group, and I feel like it really helps me deepen my relationship with others and priests and get emotional and and, you know, sort of concrete practice and teaching ideas, support from other people, sharing resources, information, insights. We meet once a month. I really look forward to it. As of this past fall, we had 61 SCBA members who were actively participating in a peer group. And we've also recently begun to offer special interest peer groups, such as priests under the age of 50, or priests who are chaplains, or priests involved in engaged Buddhism, or Zen practice and art. So those are a few different kind of special interest peer groups. We've also been offering educational opportunities kind of all along, as I mentioned before, like about the first training that took place way back in 2005. And we've offered a conference every other year for our members and associate members. But we've recently started offering more things, and partly that was born out of the pandemic when we realized, oh, we don't have to get together in person. We can offer things over Zoom. So we can do that regularly. So we've had a few different really exciting classes. Unpacking Whiteness, Reflection and Action from a Buddhist Perspective, and that looked at racial conditioning for those who identify as white, and A Guide for Change Through Zen Practice. So it's looking at what we can do to undo white supremacy from a Zen perspective. Then we also had that was just for the members, priests and associate members. We then offered a class called Many Communities, One Sangha, Exploring the Reality of Equity and Inclusion. And that one we opened up to anyone, so Sangha members could attend, even if they weren't priests. And that was very exciting and very well received. We also offered a workshop supporting families in our Sangha that was about helping Zen practitioners integrate the Dharma with their parenting and helping Sanghas be more receptive and nourishing for families. And so that also was open to everyone. We did a kind of a mini conference this past year. Usually, like I said, we do a conference every other year, but we did just a short conference this past year, and we also did a workshop on shame resilience, which was helping Dharma leaders understand how shame manifests so we're less likely to spread our shame to Sanghas, and learning the difference between shame and guilt, and learning about the components of empathy and how to practice in ways that allow for vulnerability, which I don't know about you, but when I first learned about Zen practice, it kind of seemed more like a warrior practice, like you were just supposed to grit your teeth and get through it. And so learning, like unlearning that and saying, no, it's really about opening to compassion. And I'm sure that you're doing that if you're chanting the Loving Kindness Sutra, so I was really happy to hear that. So I'll just say a few more things, and then I do want to open it up because I feel like I'm just talking a lot, and it's harder on Zoom because I'm not, like, I don't feel your presence as much. So one of the things I'm especially excited about is we've recently are just kind of on the cusp of finalizing an update to our ethics statement or code of ethics and our grievance process. And that is something that's for the organization, but also with the hope that the members could benefit from what we're developing to use it for their own sanghas. So that effort has been led by Tengku Ruff, who's the former president of the SCBA and the chair of the Ethics Task Force. We got a grant from the Hemera Foundation for this, and we were able to draft both a revised code of ethics and a grievance process for our members. And like I said, we're currently in the process of voting on these documents. So I'll just say, I'll kind of wrap it up by saying that the current mission of SCBA is, it's a little robust. I'll just read it. And then I'll say what I think about it. I mean, I agree with it, but I want to unpack it even more. So our current mission is, it says, the Soto Zen Buddhist Association is a professional organization of Soto Zen priests. Its mission is, and there's three parts. One, to preserve and promote the Buddha Dharma through the teaching and practice of Soto Zen Buddhism in North America. So that's pretty straightforward. The next is to facilitate trust, respect, and communication, ethical conduct, and education among the many sanghas of Soto Zen lineages and in the wider community. So that's some of what I've been talking about in terms of like the peer groups, the mentoring, the workshops, and such. And then the third one is to compassionately widen the transmission of Dogen Zenji and Keizan Zenji's practice and understanding in the Western world. So that sounds pretty good, but I think that there's some of us on the board who have said maybe we could say the mission in a way that's really more gets to the heart of what we do, like to say something like, our mission is to free all beings from suffering. I think that would be pretty good. We could say our mission is to free all beings from suffering, and then how do we do that? By connecting Soto Zen leaders to each other and supporting Soto Zen leaders as well as Soto Zen communities. So I would say that it's more like that. I want to have like a really sort of broad, heartfelt mission about really the freedom from suffering and really about liberation. And then I'll just close to say, because Les asked me, like, what are the, what does the SCBA hope to achieve in the short term and for the future? So I would say for the short term, and it's maybe hard to separate between like my own personal agenda and the SCBA, but it seems like most of the board at least are in agreement with this as we're doing this, revising the ethics and grievance policy. I think that would be a huge thing that we could offer to the community because it really is a way to protect students and protect each other, really, and to make and to hold ourselves accountable for the kind of leaders and people that we want to be. So to me, it's like the short term, and like I said, hopefully that voting process is going to happen soon. So revising that ethics and grievance process. And then also, I would like to see revising the standards in a way that made them more inclusive while at the same time still providing a firm foundation for priest training. So we have standards there, you know, like I mentioned, the Soto Shu has a standard of that you have to train for 2 3-month residential periods in Japan. Well, right now the SCBA has a standard of you need to do a total of 3 months residential training at an approved SCBA practice ongo that could be in the United States. And there's many different centers now that offer approved training, and it doesn't have to be 3 months all at once. It can be broken up into smaller segments. So like that's one example of something that we offer or that we require for our members. But we're looking at, can we make sure that the access part of diversity, equity, inclusion, and access is met, and that we're not having standards in a way that excludes people unnecessarily. So that, I think, is like a couple of short-term goals. And then I thought about like some medium-term goals. And I would say, as I kind of referenced, a medium-term goal might be looking at creating a big tent. So investigating different categories of membership within the SCBA, such as lay teachers, that's been looked at in the past. We'll look at it again. Sangha members or friends of SCBA and temple membership, which we don't have right now. So that, anyway, that's something that I would like to see us look at. Right now, I mean, we don't have a specific relationship with Zen temples beyond our relationship with the teachers who are members of SCBA and have temples. But it would, I think, make us stronger if we could also connect with the temples. Also, kind of medium term is ethics training for all our members. So once we get the ethics revised code of ethics in place and a grievance process, then training our members in that, how that would work. And then also extending and offering ethics training for Sangha members and temples would be something else, kind of medium term. And then as I thought about long term, I guess the big thing that came up for me is not to let the Dharma die out. So and maybe that's in the short, medium, and long term, but that's what I'm thinking about. So that's my data dump on you. I hope it wasn't too much. And I'm just interested to see if people have questions or comments.
I just want to say, I didn't know about this organization. Absolutely fantastic. Just can't see how it can't do anything but absolutely benefit the spreading of the Dharma and Soto Zen. It's absolutely amazing. Thanks for telling us about that.
Oh, well, thank you for that that support. I feel the same way, and I think more people should know about it, so I'm glad that I was able to tell you. Thank you. Lee, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I wanted to ask, in the discussions among the membership, have people discussed situations where they have needed a grievance process? Is this a very common thing in Sanghas, you know, nationwide?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how common it is. We had a recent grievance that came to us. So, you know, it's like it happens periodically. And I think one of the things that I think about is that if the only people who know about the SCBA and the grievance process are the priests and the leaders, then what happens if a Sangha member has a grievance? You know, and really the SCBA is kind of set up to not like receive every single grievance of any potential Sangha member in the whole country, because the idea is that the Sangha member would first go to their own temple and try to resolve the grievance, but sometimes it can't be resolved. And then it's like, then what happens? So it's not that there's like lots and lots of grievances going on, but that we want to be proactive and just make sure that there's an avenue for addressing it. And a lot of times with grievance, like in my own Sangha, there was just a grievance that was recently resolved. And, you know, sometimes it means that there's just something that needs to be addressed. It's not always like, okay, then the person is excommunicated. You know, like it doesn't always mean that the teacher is, you know, then leaves in shame. It's like sometimes it's just like, oh, this is the behavior that needed to be called to someone's attention. And now it can be corrected, and there can be amends made, and we can go forward.
That's great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for coming to talk with us, and it was a very inspiring talk. I remember there was a hesitation that Suzuki Roshi, Katagiri Roshi had about joining the Japanese group. And I was pleased to hear that Les was involved in this. Seems like it's something that his teacher, his lineage would really approve of. Thank you for telling us about it. I'm curious how, if there is, at the end you spoke about preventing the Dharma from dying out, how would you define what Soto Zen practice is as opposed to other, I don't know if there's anything besides Rinzai that's, or just in a broader context of religious practice.
Gosh, that is a really good question. How would I define Soto Zen practice? Because, you know, in some ways, it's like there's some things that I was taught, like in Soto Zen, we emphasize meditation, and we especially emphasize shikantaza, or kind of formless meditation. But for myself and many Soto Zen teachers that I know, we're starting to incorporate so many other different things into our practice, like doing a loving kindness meditation, or doing more kind of guided meditations, or looking at like mindfulness of breathing sutra and using phrases. And anyway, it seems like there's so many different things. And also including somatic practice, so a deep awareness of the body, of our bodies and what's happening in our bodies. And that's, now I'm realizing, oh, well, the Buddha was teaching that too. So it's like we've somehow forgot about it along the way, and now we have to loop back to it. So I guess if, you know, if I would say what is Soto Zen practice, it's just like looking at what I've received from my teachers and then what I'm carrying forward, but that it's also open to being influenced by these different streams that are coming in. And I think there's just a great opportunity now that there's so much access to information and so much access to other teachings. So I think that it's possible to bring in the different threads while still remaining true to something that's a constant. You know, like I think meditation is something that we don't want to let go of. Some of the chanting seems important as a way to convey our hearts and our minds and bodies together in that really embodied practice of chanting. But beyond that, I think there's a lot of room to include more things.
That's so lovely. Thank you.
You're welcome. So, Dave, I'm not sure if you are wanting to speak or just putting your hands in gushels. If you want to speak, go ahead and unmute.
I actually did want to follow up with a quick question to what you were just saying.
Yes.
You're probably familiar with this probably apocryphal story of many years ago, visiting Japanese Zen teacher, talking to an American Zen teacher, and the American Zen teacher was talking about the difficulties of adapting Japanese Zen practice to America and the challenges that it represented. And the Japanese teacher sort of smiled and said, yes, the first 100 years is always the hardest.
Yeah.
And I'm yeah, just right. Wondering if in the association you spend much time sort of taking stock of where we are in that transition process after so many years and where we still have to go.
Well, I think it's really hard to know when you're in it. I mean, you can look at where we're at, you know, and it's been 100 years. Next year, it'll be 100 years that Soto Zen has been in America. But it's sort of like where we're going to go, we don't know, actually. And it's, I think it's important not to know. So I think in a way it's like keep looking back where we've been, what's happening, what's important, what was important from our history, from our lineages. And then just like what's in front of us and what seems important to address in society now and in our sanghas now. And I think that's the way we have to go. I mean, there's some people who might have a certain idea, like how they want it to be. That's okay. They can move with that idea, but I like to just kind of be more, a little more in don't know mind.
Yes, I like your statement that it's important not to know, you know, not knowing is the most intimate and so forth.
Yeah. And then having said that, I still have my idea, like, well, getting ethics training, like for members and Sangha members is important. So that's something I would like to see happen, but... Beyond that, like what, if you answer the question, like what is Soto Zen going to look like in 100 years from now? I don't think we should know that. So I want it, there might be more SCBA members here, but I'm pretty sure that Teresa Boza is a member. Aren't you a member? So, hi.
Oh, hi, Susan. Yeah, I am a member, and I'm also a member of the... Diversity, Equity, Inclusivity, and Access Committee. Thank you.
And thank you, then. That's one of our most hardest working committees.
At risk of sounding like the Joe Manchin of Dharma propagation, do you have any sense of what not to do? And I ask because I'm a member of the Japanese community, and their metta organizations have come to place a great burden on the local, sometimes struggling congregations, a great burden, and it's way out of control.
Yeah.
in that organization. Big problem. I don't want that to become a big problem for our Soto Zen practice.
Can you say more about what that great burden is?
Mostly it's money.
Oh, I see.
Very. It starts off with lots of, please pardon me, lots of words that sound like what you just said. And then 3 months later, there's a budget meeting. And they levy a tax on all. It's suggested at first, and then it becomes more firmly suggested, and et cetera, et cetera.
I see.
So it's an escalation to fund. And in one case, the large organization overextended itself and spent 10 years of trying to scramble to cover that huge debt that they incurred.
Mm.
I won't name names, but...
Yeah. Well, we're trying not to do that, so I'll just say, but it's kind of a good warning. So we do have member dues, so there is that. And we recently hired an executive director, and we were able to do that because we had... quite a healthy surplus. Mm-hmm. So our idea was, well, let's hire an executive director. We can take the risk because we have a surplus. Part of what she would do, and it's a she, Allison Miller, who's great, part of what she would do is look at how can we increase our funding overall for the organization. Can we look at grants? Can we look at individual donors who aren't necessarily members? Can we look at Sangha members who might want to help? Can we increase our reach with educational programs we're offering as an income stream? I think that's a good warning to not be an organization that's just there to like perpetuate ourselves and to, you know, get money from member temples. One thing I'll just say, I don't know if it, you know, I don't know if the SCBA will go for this, but my Sangha, Clouds and Waters Zen Center, when the pandemic hit and we switched to everything on Zoom, like so many people, and we realized, like, well, we don't even know if people can, you know, if they're laid off from their jobs, what's going on. So we just immediately switched to a pay what you can model. We just said, well, we'll just take a risk. We have our budget, but we'll just say pay what you can. And for the first 6 months, our program, so like our sessions, our classes, et cetera, brought in more money than we budgeted when we were doing a pay what you can. So I think done in the right way with a spirit of really like pay what you can. And thinking about, like, if you can pay more. And if you can't, there's no guilt, is really a beautiful way to do things. So whether that's something that can happen with a national organization, I don't know. But it seems like to me having some element of that included in how we behave would be helpful.
The principle of dana, taking that which is freely given. Yes,
right.
I like that.
Right. But often, you know, in this culture, then you still have to talk about it a lot because people don't understand how that works. You know, they're used to like, well, what's the price? You know, so you have to kind of explain it. Anyway, thanks. Brenda, did you want to say something?
There we go. Hey there. Yes, thank you very much for a lovely talk. I had a question about how, I guess I don't know how SCBA sees this or is seeing it in the future or what have you. Probably it's a process, I imagine. But I guess one of the things that comes to my mind is, you know, in the transition from Japan to the U.S., what there are now is there are many more people who are, there are some people who are full-time priests, and then there's many people who also have like maybe jobs or families or other things in the United States. And Les is a perfect example of that, where he, you know, raised a family and worked at IBM for many years. And so I guess I'm wondering, and then there, you know, there's also the emphasis, you know, really that comes right down from Buddha, where he left his home. And, you know, I don't know if he asked permission or not, but, and that is seen as the ideal, really. We want to be like Buddha. So we want to leave our home. Mm-hmm. And how do you see those, kind of scoring together, as we go forward? And then, you know, what about in terms of inclusion, as you mentioned, what about those people who, for one reason or another, illness or some other, you know, financial issues or what have you, are not able to leave their home? And does that mean that they cannot really truly pursue the Buddha Dharma?
Mm-hmm. Good questions. Mm-hmm. So one thing is that most of us know that we need to somehow draw away at least a little bit, right? So that's why we do, like, okay, I'm going to sit still for 40 minutes or 50 minutes or whatever, even half an hour, even 15 minutes. I'm just going to sit still. Or I'm going to go on sesshin for a day or a weekend or a week. Because it seems really hard to change our habits just if we're just going along in our everyday life. So it seems like we need to draw away a little bit in order to really receive the Dharma in a certain kind of way. But for me, it's like for the Dharma to continue, it has to be flexible enough so that, yes, some people who, because of illness or different, or, you know, family situation or whatever, can't quite practice in the same way. So my story is, I was ordained in 1990, let's see if I can remember this right. I think it was 97, late 97. It's probably in my bio. But anyway, it was 97.
That's what it says.
97, oh yeah, I remember. In 1998, I got pregnant, and in 1999, I had a baby. So my early Zen priest training was also like mom training. So like I did a lot of sesshin, if you know, like right after I was ordained, and even I did a sesshin 2 weeks before my baby was born. I think I was in pre-labor. Mm-hmm. But then I wasn't able to do sesshins for a couple of years. And then even then, when I started doing things again, I had to be there for my son. And I wanted to be there for my son. So for me, practice was family life also. And so that was included. So I think just being flexible like that and seeing how that works. But remembering that for some time and for some people, some amount of drawing away and reducing the amount of stimuli that are coming in is really helpful to kind of get a hold of, or to get to maintain a focus on practice. And for me, now as a leader, doing so many different things in a way that feels like way harder than when I was just being a mom with a baby and practicing. So what I do is I go away, I like 2 days a month where I'm actually away in a little hut by myself. So it's like a grassroots hermitage. I'm just there by myself because I need to do it. Otherwise, I'll forget to practice in a deep way. So anyway, that's just a little bit of my thoughts around that.
Thank you.
Other thoughts or questions?
I'm curious about the inclusivity. And we say people of color, actually, I mean, maybe most of us are to some extent, I'm curious, like, are there any African Americans in the in practicing Soto Zen that are involved with the SCBA? Is there an outreach that in terms of representing people of color, I guess, and other groups that often aren't included?
Good question. We do have a few people of color, including a few African Americans, who are in members of SCBA. But we are primarily a white organization right now. And the outreach, I think, that has to happen first is an in-reach, and that's part of the class on unpacking whiteness, is looking at what can the white people in the room do in order to help transform the barriers that might be there in ourselves and in the organization. And then there is some other outreach, there is a group, an affinity group of people of color who are members of the SCBA, so that they can meet and support each other. But I think that once BIPOC folk who are potential members of SCBA, so Soto Zen priests, once they start, or even lay teachers, if we open it up to lay teachers, once they start seeing that we're really doing the work and doing the reflection and the action that needs to happen, then they'll be more likely to join. Whereas right now, I think we have a ways to go.
Thank you.
Okay, yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Susan, for your talk and all the information you shared. I want to share that I'm also a member, an associate member of SCBA.
Oh, thank you. Welcome.
I've been, I've been a dormant member. My experience is that when I got ordained by Les, Les told me, oh, and then there is this association you could be a member of, an associate member of, and I just joined. even if I'm generally very picky on organizations that I join, but then my experience while I was at Canon Do was that practicing at Canon Do was really taking all of my time. I could find apart from the family and work activities. So I didn't have time then to join activities. I think that could be the case for several priests or associate priests. But I did very much appreciate that Les shared with me some ethics document draft, super early draft, 10 years old draft of ethics document or training standards, giving me the idea that he was supporting those, and then I still have those. And and then what happened to myself is that I actually moved to Italy, where I now live, and then it made quite difficult to be part of the association. But I saw that there were other members that were based outside of the United States. With the pandemics now, with Zoom, there are new opportunities, and I've kind of rejoined, I feel, a little bit this year, some of the activities that can be done online. So my question, and I want to thank you specifically, because I had not realized that the association was defining itself as a professional association. So, but my question is about the how much American-based you see the association. Yes, Soto Shu has an office in Paris, missionary office in Paris. There is a super nice Japanese lady that speaks some English and is visiting sanghas, giving talks telling a little bit about her job. So I was wondering what are the views of the SCBA regarding international reach, outreach. Yes, and a little bit more the relationship with the Soto Shu. Thank you. Thank you, Susan.
You're welcome. So that's a very interesting question because it came up when the board or a subgroup of the board was looking at how we might want to revise our mission. So like right now, there's North America is in there. It's like stated in the mission, like that's who we are. And this came up with the board, like, well, now that there's, you know, we can reach people anywhere in the world. So maybe we just take North America off our mission and just say it's for people represented. Because we are, you know, maybe we have to have some kind of definition. So maybe it's certain lineages that are represented. So it might be evolving, I guess, is what I'm saying. And that we do recognize that there's a number of people that we have who are members who don't live in North America. So then what does that mean? Can they not be members? No, they can still be members. Yeah, I think we're exploring that. And then as far as what our relationship is with Soto Shu, I'm not really sure what it can be. So like I, as president, I've been invited to the meetings of the Association of Soto Zen Buddhists, which is, I think, the Soto Shu like equivalent of SCBA. It's hard for me to always understand all these different organizations. But my thought is that we could do some interesting things together. Like, for example, let's say there's a grievance against one of our members of SCBA. Maybe if the ASCB had a grievance committee, that their grievance committee could investigate that. And if they had a member that wears a grievance against, then our committee could investigate it. So there's not a conflict of interest. Like that would be one idea of how we might partner. But I don't know if they'll go for that. So we're just sort of like starting to explore like what it is that we could be for each other. And right now, a lot of it is just keeping communication lines open. So they're always inviting me to their meetings, and I'm updating them on what's going on with SCBA as well, so that we have that connection. And, yeah, I'm not sure what it will look like in the future. Did you have something else, or does that answer your question?
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That answered my question. I do have another question, if I might. And it's a little bit more personal question. So you are here as I think president of the association, and you gave us all this information. But I would like to hear your personal opinion and idea on the fact that lineages are very important and. Or in other words, the teacher to student relationship is very important in Zen. I think many of us are attracted to this practice by the personal relationship to one person, and that kind of mirrors the fact that this is a personal practice. Is a emphasis on the personal effort. And not an authority from outside, but some really personal effort that anyone can do, and that where our teachers are helping us with that in mysterious ways. So how that nature of our practice blends with an organization. You know, organizations are organization. Anyone, I think, of age has experience with organizations. They are needed. They are in the very much rooted in the practical world. They have some, because of mechanisms that get created, they necessarily might not be aligned always with the personal search or personal feeling. So how do you see them, so to speak? You know, the organization can take also a life of their own, have some agenda that are not, they're not a person, you know, they're not a person. Mm-hmm. And so they follow the logic, and as much as you make that logic and rules the best you can, they always have some difficulties in some corners. So how do you feel that? Do you feel that kind of tension between these two things? And then what's your take on that?
Well, what I'd like to talk about with that is about how the sort of interplay between that personal, very intimate relationship that you referred to between the student and the teacher, and then also like sort of expanding or opening that out to include more people. So, for example, at Clouds and Water, where I teach, we have a teaching team. So right now we have 4 Dharma-transmitted teachers who are there, and then we also have some other teachers, priests in training, who help with various things and are, you know, being trained to be leaders so that they're actually leading as well. And I feel like the opportunity to not be the only person for my students, like to have some other, you know, that they have some other support in seeing other teachers, and also the teachers we're supporting each other. It seems like really important to me to as the Dharma going forward. Now, that's not to say that every Sangha has to have multiple teachers in their Sangha, but I'm just saying the idea of sort of expanding out to a bigger collective that can help hold that space for that intimate relationship between the student and teacher to happen, and make sure that it's happening in a healthy and ethical way. So I kind of see like an organization like the SCBA as sort of a bigger picture of that idea of, you know, sort of helping us to hold these, to provide a container, a bigger space in which these intimate student-teacher relationships can be supported and upheld. But, I mean, it's true, like you mentioned, with any organization, yeah, there's dangers of it becoming kind of stilted and, you know, rule-based for, you know, to sort of perpetuate itself. And I think we just have to keep watching for that. But for me, I see the strong benefit of having a more collective view. And it's sort of a Mahasangha, a large Sangha, when we're looking at all these different lineages that come together in an organization such as the SCBA. So that's kind of how I see it.
Hi, Susan.
Hi.
Thank you for all the information that you have been sharing with us tonight, and also for leading the organization at a very interesting time of respecting the depth of practice while trying to keep the practice flexible. So I have 2 questions for you. Some other people have already asked this question, but I wanted to ask it again because I'm not sure I got a full answer from you. So, as you might know, we are working now on the disability survey at the DEIA. And one of the questions is still being edited, but one of the questions that we were thinking about including is to participants, what parts of Zen practice and being a priest particularly do you think are integral and cannot be changed, if any? So that would be a question for you too. And then when you mention about the possibility of changing the mission statement of the SCBA to make it broader, but then in that statement, the part that is included now about transmitting the transmission of Dogen Zenjin's understanding in the Western world wouldn't be included. And I wanted to ask you also, how important do you think moving forward is this, that kind of communicating this this respect to tradition? Or I guess that's my question. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So one thing I want to say is that, you know, if when I mentioned about sort of expanding the mission to make it more big, I wasn't thinking that then we would like not include the current mission. So it's like the current mission would be there, but it would be more like that's how we're expressing the kind of core values. So I do think that looking at Dogen Zenji and Keizan Zenji's teaching and practice is an important, I would say, integral part. Like that needs to be included in some way. There's many different ways it can be expressed, but if we're just ignoring it, then I don't know if that's Soto Zen. So that would be something I would be thinking about. And the other things that I mentioned, like Zazen practice, chanting liturgy, you know, those seem to be integral. Doing Sishin, doing some amount of residential training. Maybe that will change, like, what the amount is in terms of making sure that there's access. But it seems like some amount of drawing away and, you know, concentrated practice is important. So those are some of my thoughts about that. But I'm just one person, too, so. And I'm not going to be president forever.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sosan. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Are there any last questions for Sosan?
Okay. You're muted, Les.
Les.
If you wanted to.
I'm not muted very often. But I get caught in the trap here. I just want to say thank you again on behalf of everybody for taking the time to be with us and to enlighten everybody about what's going on in the Soto Zen world in the Western world, and for your preparation and for your warm-heartedness. Thank you for being there. I feel like we're all in good hands. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's kanno.org.